Podcast 081, Book Review of Sepp Holzer's Permaculture, Chapter 1, Part 2. Sponsored by my buddies at PantryParadis.com. They sell food preservation tools. Produce, prepare, preserve your own harvest. All right, so we're moving on with more of Chapter 1 of Sepp Holzer's Permaculture. I've got Kelda on the phone again, and last time we just had so much to say. We only made it 10 pages into Chapter 1 before it was like, oh, man, it's like been an hour and a half of podcasts already. So we're going to try and get further along, and rather than trying to say, let's just skip over a lot, I think it's better to, like, you know what? Let's really give this the respect it deserves. And frankly, after, you know, reading yet another 10 pages, so into this, I'm thinking it does deserve a lot of respect. This is excellent stuff. I usually for books and movies and stuff that I review, I'm usually pretty quick to find things to kick in the nuts.
Yeah.
And this is the gold here. This is the stuff. So I don't want to race past it. I want to digest every bit, you know, that is legitimately okay to digest over a podcast.
Okay.
How are you feeling about it, Kelda?
Well, yeah, there's definitely some good stuff in there and stuff I want to play around with. So. But I didn't. It was interesting. I didn't have anything that was like, oh my gosh, I totally disagree with the last 10 pages. So we'll kind of see how that works out.
Okay. So right from the very beginning, we got setting up a permaculture system, general questions. So I want to read this, but this is the very first little bit. Many people want to manage their land in a natural way or to switch from using traditional farming methods to permaculture ones and ask me about the best way to make use of their land. I have to ask them some questions of my own first. What is their goal and what do they expect from their land? Okay, the reason why I... found that chunk and needed to talk about that chunk. It has a lot more to do with my own sinister stuff.
Okay.
And it's like so often I go to some place or I've been invited somewhere or and then people, you know, oh, well, hey, maybe you could tell me what I do here. And then I try to ask these questions and here's the answer. Like, what do you want to do with your land? The answer is, oh. What do you expect from your land? I don't know. And so basically, well, first off, a lot of people seem to still want landscaping. It's like, I want everything in a row, and I want all the soil exposed, and I want it to be clear that I make nature my personal bitch. And so this is what people have been trained is like the look to go for. So a lot of people still want that. And so moving into a world of permaculture where we're respecting nature and working alongside of nature, there's a lot of that I don't know, they're not ready to sign up for just yet. And but even more so, I know that there's – so for example Sepp emailed me and asked me to go up to this piece of land where he's going to be giving this presentation. Mm-hmm. I'd been putting it off because I get tons of people who say, hey, come look at my land. Hey, come look at my land. And I'm just trying to juggle all these different things. And so finally I got an email from Sepp, go look at this land. Okay, I'm going. So the next day I go up there, and a bunch of other permaculture folks met me up there. And so I asked this gal, she's got 90 acres, and I asked her, like, okay, so what do you want to do here? She has no idea. So, which is like the norm, you know. I got Sepp coming, Sepp's going to do his thing, and I want some of that.
Yeah.
Whatever that is.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, but of course, Sepp kind of wants to hear, like, okay, what is he doing when he's getting there? What kind of thing is going on? And so what I did was, I said, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do with the land, and then you tell me exactly how that sucks. Because, and this is an old trick that I got from my software engineering days, because I would get to some place, and it's like, okay, we're going to pay you, Paul Wheaton, this enormous bale of money to make us software. And I try and sit down and find out what it is they want the software to do, and they've got no idea. And but, you know, they wanted to help. And it's like, so what I do is I make some piece of software which I know doesn't do what they want, but I really don't have any idea of what it is that they want, and they don't have an idea of what it is, so I make something,
right?
And then once they have it in front of them, oh, this is not what we asked for.
Right.
Well, paint, it's not going to work. It has to be blue. Well, you know, they never said anything about blue before. But now that they can look at something that clearly sucks, now they can say what it is that they want.
Right.
Suddenly, the English language comes back to their heads, and it all comes pouring out.
Yeah, I found that to be true a lot. Sometimes, I mean, they have this idea, you know, that the expert's going to see the land and know what to do with it. But in permaculture, it all has to do with that relationship that person has with the land, which is hard for someone. If you're meeting for the person and the land for the first time, very hard to piece it all together until you get to know them better. And a lot, yeah, a lot of times people want something that looks good, but not be able to vocalize what looks good to them, which is interesting. That's the part where it's like, I really want them to go and take pictures and compare it to something, because you start doing something and they might say, well, that doesn't look good. It's like, well, you don't like the look of straw, you don't like the look of cover crop, like, what's the look good look to them? So, yeah, for sure.
Well, I think another thing is I can go to a piece of land and I can picture, you know, 5, 10, and 20 years into the future, and I can plan something out for this piece of land, and it's like totally changing everything. And then it's like then I'll attempt to try and describe some of it to the people, and they'll stop me 10 seconds in. Oh, no, that won't work. So it's like my whole vision has just been flushed down the toilet, and I never even got to the good part. I mean, so all I'm trying to say is that this whole thing about asking the questions and trying to help people is an enormous challenge.
Right.
And it's like it usually just doesn't even get very far. And I think really plus there's another aspect here too. I think it's I've heard this advice several times, and it's like when you get to a new piece of land, do nothing for the first year. Do nothing at all. Learn the land. Observe what's already there and learn. Now, I don't think that that's an... I've never followed that. But I do believe there's a great deal of truth to that.
You'll have to repeat that again. I actually... I cut out for me.
Okay. So when you get to a new piece of land, do nothing for the first year.
Observe for a year. Okay, got it.
Just observe. So I've never done that, but I believe there's a lot of truth to that. And so then it's like, okay, now it's like, okay, you got onto this land 3 minutes ago. Tell us what to do.
Exactly. Which plant do I put there?
Yeah, you know, and it's kind of like, hey, can I walk around a little bit first? You know, can I bounce ideas off of you first? Can I just talk about some rough? But you know, I do kind of think that a lot of people, it's kind of like, okay, I'm going to pay for you to be here for 2 hours. And at the end of the 2 hours, within the 2 hours, I expect for you to have conveyed all of your permaculture knowledge to me, and then I'll have a clear understanding of what it is I'm going to do with my land. And then the first 3 minutes, okay, you've been here 3 minutes, go! Start spewing. You don't have a lot of time.
I just love to bring in what Jordan Fink did for our permaculture class a couple of weeks ago. We brought him in because he's got more design experience than other teachers that I know, as far as like going through the design process. And we gave them a whole extra day. This is a permaculture class to learn design, and he talked a lot about figuring out what the client's techniques, they're saying techniques, but then behind that there's goals, and then behind that there's values. And as soon as you can cut through, figure out what the value is, then the technique will be totally, totally different. And so there's a lot of discussion about how you get to, like, you know, someone wants an apple tree, but what do they want an apple tree for? Is it for shade? Is it for food? Is it because their grandmother used to grow apples? And once you get down to what that is, then that opens up this other wide variety of techniques. So values, finding what they value in the situation is really key.
That's true. That's true. Very, very good point. I also think that the stuff that Dave Bainline does with the Bullock Brothers, they've got that project where someone will hire them and then they'll come up with permaculture designs and as the artifact from their time with the client, they have this book full of maps and cool stuff. I mean, if nothing else, just getting that book of your place is like a piece of awesome art. And I do think that while there's a lot to that that I don't agree with, I do think that if nothing else, it's cool. It's really cool to see your property done up and all these different ideas that they've come up with. And if nothing, you know, I think that's a powerfully educational thing for a lot of people on what can be done.
I like it because it starts that tutoring process where the person coming in, the permaculture person, is a consultant, where it's like if the client can't read their own landscape to understand what's going on, then here's a physical book that's made for you that describes the landscape in English, you know, like not in like plant language. So, a really good resource that way.
I think there's a lot to be said for these guys that are willing to come to somebody's property that you know, they've got a lot of permaculture expertise and they're willing to come to somebody's property and actually consider what it is, you know, what the people have to say about their own property and what it is that they think that they want, and to try and take the time and patience to fish out from the people, you know, how to build a plan and all of this kind of stuff. Because frankly, I kind of, if their stuff is not aligned with my stuff, I kind of just want to leave. I get bored real fast. And on top of that, Sepp, when he was out in Washington State a few years back, I remember him, like the presentation that I think one of the interpreters gave or something like that, was that Sepp does not want to do anything other than if Sepp had this land, here is what Sepp would do. He doesn't even want to consider anything else. He wants to come. He wants to look at it. He doesn't want to hear from whoever owns the land. They could just go stand in a corner and be quiet.
Well, and that's interesting because he does bring up this client interview, quote-unquote, in the book, which maybe he does when he has a longer relationship with the person if it's happening, like, in Austria. But you're right, here in the United States, it was like, with Matilda's property, it did seem very much like Sepp's going to go into a situation like he's the own client, like he's living at the land, and that's what he would produce. But
well, maybe it had to do with the fact that every time I was there, there's like 30 other people there.
Right.
You know, and it's like, you convey to these people the stuff that's limited based upon this person's limited understanding of what Sepp talks about?
Uh-huh.
Or do you just totally go full Sepp, you know, and really get everything he's got to say? Maybe that was it. Although I've perhaps errantly embraced it, and it's kind of like I have a hard time for most of the places I go to wanting to talk about anything other than what I would do if I were there, thinking, I know, it's horribly arrogant, and the weird thing is a lot of people groove on it, so I'm doing okay with it. And it's kind of like, I call it the crushing your dreams speech. Mm-hmm. So I come along, and people have got all these ideas of things that they want to do, and it's like, okay, now let me tell you why all that's stupid. And then I'm going to just lay out what I would do if I owned the land and based on what I see there. And so I frankly encourage people to not hire me. I've got other goals. But right. Some people just seem like, oh, they want to hear it from me. And so it's like, okay, I can come make you sad. I'm all right with that.
Yeah, I mean, that has value, but I wonder, you know, when in this consultation, how much of that they actually implement and how much of the lifestyle that you're assuming that they'll fulfill they actually end up fulfilling. So,
no, and you know, sure. At the same time, though, I get to a lot of these places and they want to talk about landscaping and they don't want to have animals and they want to bring in the wildlife, but they want to make a farm. And so it's all this stuff which sounds like they want to have their cake and eat it too.
Uh-huh.
And it's kind of like, we want to have a fucked up system. Can you help us with that? How do we make this fucked up? How can we make it, just slightly less fucked up than a monocrop? Or, just a bunch of conifer trees. How can we keep the conifer trees and have, some flowers?
Yeah, and it's got some weird friends, Paul. I think we should just move on in the topic.
Well, all I'm trying to say is that that's so often what it sounds like, and it just, I get there, and I feel like rather than being of help, it's I'm just getting really angry and annoyed, and I'm not really interested. I don't want to play. Whereas, based on what you've just said, there are people out there that are willing to come and listen to people talk about what they think permaculture means and how they want to get a design at something like that.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, I guess my greater point is that I am not going to compete with those people. I'm not going to compete with the people that are working as active designers. And in fact, I want my empire to support those people. I want to get those people listed out at permies.com. So when somebody says, I'm looking for a consultant in my area to come give me advice, that they'll call those guys instead of calling me. And I'm already getting a lot of people that are like, I want to pay far too much money to have Sep come to my property and tell me what to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm kind of thinking, boy, you know what? I think before you do that, you should probably have a different permaculture person come and talk to you. And plus, I'm not sure. I mean, what would Sep do if coming to somebody's property? Would Sep gave them advice? I mean, it's kind of like I kind of feel like what it is they want the best. So they're willing to pay the highest price to get the best. And I'm kind of thinking, you know what? I imagine that they will be far happier with somebody in their area who will actually listen to what they want.
And right.
Sep in here says he asks all these questions, but I kind of wonder, does he really? Maybe if you pay him enough, he will.
Well, I bet it's different when he's home. When he's he can just go over to the client site and talk to them, and come back with design. When he comes just for a couple of weeks, he just wants to get started. Especially if there's 30 people waiting for a class and wanting to see how he does his thing.
Yeah.
What if the site suggests to him that he doesn't make hugelkultures or crater gardens? I don't know. Would he still do it? Maybe. I don't know. So
maybe another thing is that if it's his next door neighbor, mm-hmm. then he'll take his time and visit because he wants to develop a relationship with that person, as opposed to somebody who's in the United States that he's thinking he'll probably never see again.
Right.
And so I don't know. Maybe these things all play in. But he does say in here that he's going to ask these questions. He's got a long list of different things. And if nothing else, for somebody who's reading this book and trying to figure out how to apply the stuff in this book to their own stuff, these are good questions to ask.
Mm-hmm.
All right. The next blob I've got marked off is, this is great. I love this. Seeds can be grown in cracks, clefts, or holes in steep slopes or even rock faces. For example, I planted sweet chestnut seeds in clefts in the rock. Afterwards, I filled them up with leaves and sowed broom seeds over the top. To my surprise, the most magnificent sweet chestnut trees grew, and the broom produced the most beautiful flowers. What happened? The layer of leaves covering the sweet chestnut seeds gave them enough moisture to germinate. The roots found their way from the cleft down into the soil and could even force themselves through the rock. The microclimate helps both the broom and the sweet chestnut to thrive. It's just so awesome.
Yeah, it's beautiful. He really, he's got microclimates down. It's a really good example.
Yeah.
Of nurse plants, of, creating guilds, working with nature, what nature gives you. It's awesome.
So the next, I've kind of marked off this blob about north-facing slopes. So he's kind of got a whole paragraph, big paragraph, dedicated to the north-facing slopes. And I had to read this paragraph three times, and it's kind of like, well, all that kind of sounds like it would work on a south-facing slope or an east or west slope, but I'm having a really hard time seeing it on a north-facing slope. And so basically what I kind of get the impression is that he's kind of trying to create south-facing slopes on a north-facing slope.
Right. He's talking about creating, like, heat traps and things on the north-facing slope. And I think he mentions it later, but another interesting idea as far as holding heat is I usually think of putting windbreaks in areas where there's wind coming onto the property. But he also talks about planting when you're creating heat islands with rocks or with different shaping to actually plant a windbreak to protect that heat, too.
So. True. Keep that heat hanging around there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, all very good ideas, all very good. So, all right, so I read this correctly then, that he's trying to, because he doesn't ever say, oh, on your north-facing slopes, try to make some south-facing slopes, but, you know, smaller. Make them, you know, like 4 to 8 feet tall.
Well,
but
yeah,
but then he starts talking about reflecting ponds, and I'm thinking, okay, now that's going to be hard
right.
to get the sunlight to reflect. You've got to have like a bigger spot there. But I was kind of thinking, well, I mean, if you've got like only something that's like 4 feet, like a pond that's only 4 feet across, it still works as a reflecting pond.
True, yeah.
And then you got this, so like if you just kind of make the whole, you know, south-facing slope on your north-facing slope just like 10 feet wide. You can do that. You can really get that to sing.
Yeah.
So
It's kind of like using straw in like a dark backyard as straw as a mulch. It's still lighter than it would have been with a darker mulch, even though the yard isn't necessarily getting light. It's kind of interesting.
Right, right. So the next stuff I've got marked off is on page 14. Do you have anything to talk about before page 14?
Well, let's see, he's getting in the soil. Oh, it's just cool to read the assessing the soil thing, just because we did that at class. There's a whole, we've got a handout for it, but it's kind of like a flow diagram where you take a piece of soil and you put it in your hand and you wet it, and then you go through all these different, he's talking about making it, you know, rolling it and seeing if it's sticky, seeing if it's sandy, and anyway, you go through the flow diagram doing all of these different things, and by the end, you know if you have loam or clay loam or sandy soil. It's a fun process, and so I was just in a class where we were doing that yesterday, so it was cool to see Steph talking about that as well.
Right. I just kind of felt like, you know, I've seen the whole make the snake thing in tons of books and websites, and it seems like that's kind of old hat, whereas I kind of feel like this book has so much really excellent and really new, really innovative, really big leap type of stuff that I kind of skipped over it.
Okay, go for it. That's fine.
So then I went on to indicator plants is what I've got marked off next. Because well, there are books about indicator plants. Like there's that book Weeds and What They Tell.
Yeah.
And it's come up in a few different places. I think that this is really rather robust. And he goes into a fair amount of detail. And I think this is probably one of the better examples that I've seen. And so I marked off a part where he said, oh, this is kind of funny. I marked this off because I've had a 3-hour debate with Helen, which never went to podcast because I said, well, let's do a podcast. Here we are arguing about this. Let's just put it on a podcast. No, she's got to go look it up and prove it and everything, but she can't be bothered. And so, all right. But anyway, so here's Sepp is saying, if there are nettles, hogweed, or orach, what's orach? Do you know what that is?
I wonder if what we call auric, we don't spell with an E at the end. It's kind of like a mountain spinach.
Okay. Then the soil is rich in nitrogen. And so Helen insists that nettles are not a nitrogen indicator, and I insist that they are a nitrogen indicator. So, and so here I've got validation from Sepp. Yay!
What you wanted. Yeah, I definitely tend to think of nettles in rich soil. I can't think of, you know, yeah, nitrogen is a different one, but definitely rich. Like they like to grow where it's It's really, it's like chocolate cake, you know?
True, true. I can't think of a time I've ever seen nettles in anything other than soil that's like, yeah, like chocolate cake. I like that. That's good. Like chocolate cake. It's like very, very dark and rich and moist. Mm-hmm. I mean, there might be a couple of times I've seen nettles in a spot that was not particularly moist, but it was still moist-ish. You know what I'm saying? Like, I've never seen nettles in a dry place. Never, ever, ever. But, you know, always someplace a little bit of moisture.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, one of the plants I thought was cool to see in there was silverweed. So do you know much about that plant, Paul?
No. I don't know anything about it.
So that was one of the plants, silverweed and clover, springbank clover, were grown by the indigenous tribes around here in the Puget Sound area, in the wet area where it's flooded, you know, maybe part of the day or seasonally. And so they had garden beds down there where they're growing potent the silverweed and redbank clover for the edible roots. So whenever I see that silverweed, I just get excited because it's such a cool thing that we had garden beds at the, you know, right next to Puget Sound in this area. So I was looking at the plants, mostly kind of geeking out on which plants do I know that are growing in Austria.
Well, I know that apparently sep is wild for Native American stuff. Just bonkers, passionate, crazy.
And the folks in Ireland are too. We've got a lot of cool plants over here, for sure. A lot of cool berries that grow well.
Okay. I know that when he was in here a few years ago that there was one day where he didn't teach anything because he was off at some kind of thing, an all-day thing with one of the local tribes. And I think that I think they made him an official member of the tribe, and they gave him all kinds of gifts, which he wore the next day that he came back to class. Hmm. What's that?
Is that the Chehalis tribe? Do you know which one?
I don't remember which one it was, but I know that he was just excited to go.
Right.
Just really looking forward to it. And when he came back, it was like he's just glowing all over about how awesome it was, and he is in love with these people. And then I was visiting with one of the Team SEP people who was telling me about how he just goes on and on about it all the time. It's like everything's about the Native American folks, and it all ties in. So I'm not so any so when there's stuff and there's stuff in here that seems like, oh, well, you know, that doesn't seem like it. I mean, that's a Native North American thing. Then I keep thinking that it's because he probably brought it in because it's like, how can I turn the Krambiter hop to be something more Native American-esque?
Well, I'm wondering if he knows the historic significance of silverweed. And so maybe when we visit, you know, when he's here in May, it'd be cool to show him. He's going to be like, this plant, this was a really important Native foods plant. Still is. So, yeah.
Maybe it would be a good thing to make a list of stuff to ask him when he's here.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe it would be a good thing to make a list of stuff to ask him, and maybe I can get answers before he gets here.
Whoa, you got connections.
He emailed me, and I went and did the thing for him. That took a day. So I think he owes me, you know, maybe answers to a couple of quick little questions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I can swing something. It's possible. All right. The next little bit I have marked off is in the same paragraph. If there is a large quantity of sorrel, the land will be suitable for growing Jerusalem artichokes and sunflowers. And I remember when he was here, one of the things he said that I thought was really cool, but it's like he said it like eight different times, because like each day, because the people that were organizing it, they did just a poor job of organizing it. I mean, other than the one that you did.
Right.
They there was like all this overlap, and so it's like so people like me that were signed up for like 10 days, or I did actually 12 and a half days, they would hear a lot of the same stuff over and over again. I ended up hearing this over and over again. It was that wherever you see ferns, bracken ferns specifically, wherever you see ferns, that's a great place to plant sunchokes and potatoes. Not quite sure what it's indicating and how they line up, but
well,
there you go.
There's a lot of different types of ferns, too. So, I mean, we have bracken in the alkaline.
But then, I don't know. I know, but of course, where he is, it's probably going to be, you know, dominantly bracken fern.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, yeah, right, where he was standing at the moment, which was in the Puget Sound area, then there are lots of different kinds of ferns, and they tend to prefer a more acidic soil. But potatoes prefer a more acidic soil, too. So, don't know. Maybe it is all ferns, and somehow I was thinking bracken fern specifically, but that might have just been my own little addition. But he was saying ferns, and then of course you always got to try and figure that there could be a little bit going on with the interpreter aspect.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah. So although the interpreters that we had, were all at least moderately savvy with SEP stuff. So you know, like permaculture people.
Yeah, it'd be cool to have Suzanne back. I thought she was the best, actually. Yeah.
Right, right. It would be cool. I liked her. Yeah, Suzanne. And then Gerta, is that right? Did I pronounce that right? She told me, when I first tried saying it, she told me I was pronouncing her name wrong.
Oh, gosh.
I'm sure I said Gerta. It's Gerta. So,
yeah, that's right. I remember her.
I'm a doofus American. I speak doofus American.
I know.
American doofus.
I've been saying Kremaderhof, but like, who knows? We're both butchering it. I don't know German.
I'm saying your name with a dialect. Get over it. All right, but she was great. I really liked her too. But she was only there for like the first week, I think, and then she had to go back to Austria. I think she was like Sepp's neighbor or something. She wanted to come to the United States and have a good time. So moving along in the book again. Then he's got this section of like different kind of indicator species for different kinds of things. So he's got in this list, he's got nitrogen rich soil,
mm-hmm.
Nitrogen poor soil, alkaline soil, acid soil, dry soil, wet soil, and compacted soil.
Mm-hmm.
All of these, I think, are really, you know, this is really good stuff to kind of, because one of the things I remember is I remember talking to him, and the weird thing is that when he was in Washington, most of the classes, I sat in the front row, and there'd be like 60 people in the room, but he pretty much just talked to me. And it's like the other 60 people were there, you know, just watching our conversation.
Oh, boy.
So, well, I don't know. For the ones in that, what was that? That was some sort of Grange Hall.
Uh-huh.
I mean, a lot of them, it seems like that's just exactly the way it went down. And in fact,
I didn't go to any of those, yeah.
He would refer to a picture in a book, and he would show me the book and put it down in front of me and point at the picture. and then you'd go on talking, and then other people would say, hey, can we pass that book around and look at it? Oh, right, yeah, sure.
Well, it might be when the squeaky wheel gets the grease, you know, maybe.
There's probably a lot of that, because I am the squeaky wheel almost wherever I go.
Yeah, yep.
I'm just that obnoxious. So, but yeah, at the thing that you did, I think I was sitting more towards the back because it was so cramped. I just kind of felt like if I sat at the front, I'd be blocking half the room.
It was small, yeah.
It was small, but there was like 30, 35 people packed into that little thing. And so I tried to not be a billboard. And, but anyway.
Okay.
So when I say that I was talking to him about something, I can't remember for sure if it was like in the middle of a class that I was talking to him about something, or you know, offline. And the thing that you did, I thought it was really great. We had a lot of offline time,
mm-hmm.
and then I spent a lot of time visiting with him then. And you just set up all this time between classes or after or before where there was something going on so we could all kind of sit around and eat and visit. And that was like some of the best stuff. So All right. Anyway, so this is like this whole page where I feel like it is not, it would be inappropriate for me to just read off what's on this page. People got to go buy the book and read the species that are listed under how to tell if this is a nitrogen-rich soil or a nitrogen-poor soil. But then the book goes into showing, for all these categories, a bunch of pictures of these plants, like drawings, artwork.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
All right, I'm up to page 19. Where are you?
Well, wherever you are. I kind of write down notes and scribble in the book. And
oh, okay. I'm
I just want to find a cool thing about compaction, about compacted soils that I just learned this weekend, too. And that compacted soils is anaerobic, right? And so that's actually creating alcohol. And so that's why roots don't grow into compacted soils, because they don't want to grow into alcohol. And so some roots can take that better. So that's just kind of interesting, because he's got compacted soils as one of those categories.
So the plants that do well in compacted soils, those are our drunkards.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that like the hooch.
Yep. All right.
I never knew that. That's a good one. That's a good one.
And then also, that's why slugs like compacted soil, because like they like beer, right?
Well, and there is that whole thing about, oh, here's a great slug trap. Put out a dish of beer.
Right.
All the slugs will go find it, and they're drawn to it, and then they drown.
Uh-huh.
Or who knows what. They just, their livers shrivel up. I'm not sure. But how does it, I mean, I know that I've heard of a lot of people saying that it works and everything, but that you have to keep replacing the dish of beer.
Right. But it was interesting as far as if you're trying to alleviate slugs and you have compacted soil, maybe address the compacted soil instead of think about the slug, deterrence or whatever, because that's your primary problem.
Oh, so they like the hooch, and if you just de-hooch your soil,
right,
then they're like, this place sucks.
Yep.
Let's go to the neighbors. They got hooch over there.
Right. So we can move on, but I just thought that was a cool thing to throw out.
I didn't know that. That is an awesome idea. If it works, if it's true, if it's all true. But that does make sense. I like that. I hope it works. I'd like to hear more about it. All right. I've got so this is kind of a new thing to me. I've never marked up books before. I never like to do that, but because there's, you know, a couple thousand people listening to this, I figured it was okay to do. So I'm going through marking off paragraphs that I like, that I want to comment on. So the next one is on page 19. It's under design ideas, and it's about having test areas. Plants that, according to the experts, should not be able to grow here can be cultivated on the Kramerhof regardless. If I had not tried, I never would have thought it possible. For instance, I can grow many varieties of kiwi, lemons, and grapes in sun traps. I just kind of, you know, so of course he grows all kinds of citrus up there, which, you know, it's pretty well known that you're not supposed to be able to grow any kind of citrus anywhere but in tropical or subtropical areas like Florida.
Right.
You know, and that they just, I mean, the first time a freeze comes along, they're done. They die. They're gone. And Sepp spent like the better part of one day talking about a lot of his tricks and techniques for getting citrus to grow in an area where it gets to be 20 degrees below zero. And at the same time, I still felt like he didn't share all of his secrets. And there were a couple of things he alluded to, and when I asked him very specific questions about it, he said, Paul, you have to read from the Book of Nature, which is his cheap-ass excuse.
Yes.
Every time he's got something that he doesn't want to share.
Yeah.
Like, I'm on to it. I'm on to the trail.
But you got to admit, he's correct. He's not, like, lying to you. He's just...
Well, he's avoiding me. He's dodging the question. I mean, and so then, after about the 12th time he did this to me, I said, okay, you know what? It turns out I'm really stupid, and I don't happen to have the Book of Nature with me. Perhaps you could tell me what you read in the Book of Nature when you were doing this before. And then he just waves me off. So
I would read from the Book of Nature on this one. I mean, I'd still be it'd be fun to try some citrus, but he might get more hot, you know, like heat units during the summer than we do here, even though he's farther up in elevation, just because we have these white sky days, you know, all the time. So
now, when you're saying we, you're thinking in, you're currently at this moment over in the Puget Sound area.
Yeah, that's my we. Yeah.
So you're west of the Cascades. You're not far from Seattle,
right?
And where gray days are, you know, there's plenty of them. I, on the other hand, am in Missoula, Montana.
Right.
Well, so I don't have that problem that you're suffering from.
Yeah, totally. And so I mean, spring break over there, I remember just being like, wow, it can be hot already by then, and sunny, and people are in tank tops, and it's, you know, spring over here, you know, pretty wet.
It can be cold and wet.
It's wet until June, yeah. It's, yeah, for sure.
And I think that's an interesting thing to say about the difference between, like, Seattle. And I'm just going to – I know you're not in Seattle, but I'm going to say Seattle because people know where that is.
Okay.
So the difference between Seattle and Missoula, you would think Missoula, wow, very short growing season.
Mm-hmm.
You can't hardly anything you can grow because the growing season is so short. But actually, our growing season starts 3 weeks after Seattle and ends 3 weeks before Seattle. So it's like the growing season is not that much shorter than Seattle.
Yeah, yeah. And that's comparable to our, like, up near Mount Rainier, places like Eatonville, Enumclaw. You might even get a slightly longer growing season.
And on top of that, we tend to have gobs more sunshine all year than Seattle.
Yep.
And it's like the rainfall in Seattle, you think it's a lot, but it's actually, I'm going to say only 30 inches. Because isn't it, like, if you go west of Seattle over to the Olympic Peninsula, they have that Ho rainforest, and isn't it like they get like 260 inches of rain a year? Something
I don't know exactly. It just dumps. I actually consider Seattle a dry spot compared to a lot of the surrounding area.
Which is my point. Because Seattle is 30, but the funny thing is if you go to like Bellevue or Issaquah, which is east of Seattle, so towards the mountains, inland, towards the inland from Seattle, the rainfall actually doubles. It's 60.
Yeah.
It's 60 inches a year. So, Seattle's kind of like this weird little dry spot. And then when it rains in Seattle, it's kind of like this drizzly kind of, kind of like it's not a real rain. It's like this sad little pathetic rain.
That's what it is. You go outside and it's all moist.
it's like you go out and you get wet, but you don't remember it raining at all.
Right.
Whereas here in Missoula, when it rains, you know it. It's monthly rain. It's really coming down. It's pouring.
Wow, I can't believe I've ever been in Missoula when it's raining.
Yeah, and so here we are, mountain desert. We do get 13.9 inches of rain per year,
mm-hmm.
But when it rains, boy, it just really this deluge. You're going to get soaked, and fast. Whereas in Seattle, it's like and they'll have a decent rain once in a while in Seattle, but most of the time it's just this kind of misty thing, where it's wet outside, but it's like the cumulative rainfall is like nothing.
Right. And I think our point was citrus might do better in something like Missoula rather than like the foothills of the Cascades on the wet side. So we'll see. We should all experiment.
True. I think it's possible in both areas. So, all right, next, the next little blurb. Many experts claim that Lungau is not suitable for growing cereal crops, and that the higher areas are even less so. Despite this, barley, wheat, oats, rye, and even flax and sunflowers ripen fully on our farm at 1,500 meters above sea level. However, this only works with old hardy varieties. These varieties, unlike the standard European Union-approved seeds, can cope with the poorest soils and the most extreme temperatures. The nutritional value and content of the cereals I grow on my mountain pasture is far better than that of the cereals grown as a monoculture. So I just kind of feel like that little blurb there just said like three different huge things in one gob. One is the power of the nutrition and flavor of polyculture. Another is the whole message about how there's all these places that say, oh, you can't do that, or you can't grow that, or that won't work, or that's impossible. And it turns out that their knowledge set is limited. But yet that's the message that they broadcast, and therefore that's the message that most people believe.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, a lot of this stuff he's not doing with any sun traps either. So he's not, like, creating a special microclimate for it. He's just being smarter about it. And a lot of this stuff also comes back to, like, you know, having good soil. Oh, yeah, that won't grow here. And, you know, what they mean to say is that won't grow here if you have crappy soil, which most people do. But if somebody happens to, like, spend a little bit of time trying to, you know, arrange decent soil, it'll grow fine.
Yeah. Well, so, and I, you know, and of course, seed saving and having to be locally adapted to that region. And he said heritage breeds works. Yeah, for sure.
So a little farther down, here's my next little blurb that I've marked off. Scientific research has shown that the nutritional value of many fruits increases when they are grown at higher altitudes. This is mainly the result of the harsh, cold nights, which help to improve the flavor. Growing in these so-called unfavorable locations also makes it possible to offer high-quality, aromatic fruit at times of the year when there is very little competition. Specialist distilleries that use organic fruit and berries are particularly enthusiastic. Our products are used to make distillates, juices, vinegar, and cider. The price is higher than the usual market price because the product is of a higher quality. This more than makes up for the lower yield compared to that of fruit grown in, quote, favorable, quote, condition locations. All right. First, I've got to brag that I translated British English to American English.
With the cord, yeah.
Does your version have American English, or is it still also the British English?
Well, they said courgette instead of zucchini. That's the only thing I caught.
What about unfavorable with a U?
Oh, you were able to translate that, Paul.
I was.
That's pretty amazing.
I knew what they were trying to say, even though wasn't American English.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, damn, I'm good. All right. I thought this had tons of, like, the nutritional value of fruits increases when they're grown at higher altitudes. That line right there is a big one. I never knew that. And I could see it. I think I could see why that could be. That is just very cool. And then, of course, he also talks about how he's able to get a higher than market price.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of comes back to where I think that this is a big part of another flavor of innovation is to try a variety of different markets and find the market that you really groove on. I mean, I think that's a big part of permaculture. I know that when I had my farm on Mount Spokane, I was trying a lot of different things and selling to a lot of different people and a lot of different stuff and everything. And a lot of the things I tried didn't do so good, but when it came to pork, I did awesome. And so then that became my primary industry was pork. But I kept trying other things to try and find out what could do well. And I've read stories of other farmers who, like, they get a sawmill and they would try selling wood, and there was all these things they thought would work out. And then 3 years of trying all kinds of different things later, they finally hit on this market where they make 10 times as much money if they cut it into this weird size
right. For
this industry that they never knew existed in their area. And it was just a matter of continuously trying new things until finally they found a niche that they could fill and suddenly get, you know, paid 10 times more for doing the same amount of work. So I'm glad to see that he found these other markets, and I think it's a good tip for a lot of the farmers that are listening in. Search for that niche. And then he mentions the lower yield that he gets from such from being so high up.
Oh, yeah. Well, I also like how he just talks about, you know, you follow the ripening berries up the hill, which, man, is just age-old tradition, and especially around here where we have so many native berries and other places. So he's just kind of tweaking that so he's getting more kinds of fruit, but just following it up the hillside as far as harvest.
That was good. Since his business model now is, and it's not that much different from what he probably did before this too, but his business model now is people come to his farm, they pay the 95 euros, they walk onto his farm, and it's like they could pretty much, if it's warm out, they could pretty much count on there being cherries somewhere on the land. Whereas like here in Montana, we have flathead cherries like around the 4th of July, and then they're done.
Mm-hmm.
You show up if you show up the end of June, you don't get any. The first of July, okay, you get tons and tons and tons and tons. 2 weeks later, there's not a cherry to be found. And so as opposed to this model where it's like, you know, there's this whole range of times when you can come and get cherries.
Right.
Brilliant. Next blurb. I have also introduced mushrooms into my experiments. According to experts, shiitake mushrooms can only be cultivated at lower altitudes because they need a great deal of warmth. As an experiment, I inoculated a 50-centimeter thick oak log with shiitake mushroom spawn at 1,500 meters above sea level. Afterwards, I sunk the log 30 centimeters into the ground and the same way up as it would have been growing. I'm screwing this all up. I'm trying to provide it with the necessary water.
Yeah, right.
2 years later, the first mushrooms appeared, but there were so many of them that the entire log was covered. Mushrooms continued to appear every now and then until the first frosts. It has been more than 10 years, and the log is still producing new mushrooms each year. In the last few years, shiitake mushrooms have even started to come up through the earth around the log. For 10 years, I have done nothing to help the mushrooms grow. I have merely harvested them.
Yeah, that was really cool. And one question I had is, he said 50 centimeters thick was the log. He must not mean wide, right? I mean, that's really, so, I mean, it's a pretty massive piece, but.
So 50 centimeters thick, that would be like 20 inches? Yeah, that would be like 20 inches thick, right?
Okay. Yeah.
It's not a jumbo log, but it's pretty big.
Right. Well, because I was curious how a yield for 10 years, we were just talking about this in class yesterday, where you get a log going with mushrooms in maybe 2 to 3 years. So I was impressed with the 10 years and thinking that, you know, the log is decomposing at that point. And so the mushrooms are also eating up the wood as it's kind of like maybe falling off the log. Like that's why they're growing below it.
Well, okay, so it's like 20 inches thick, mm-hmm. and he buried it about 12 inches deep. So it's two-thirds of it's buried, and a third of it is sticking out, right? Is that what he says?
I think maybe it's like 50 centimeters wide. Anyway, I think... Why didn't he have a picture of this? I don't know.
I'm thinking somehow it's like a log that might be like 10 feet long.
Okay, right. Which then it's like, wow, that's cool to get a yield for 10 years. I'm sure a lot of people could like up the size that they're doing these inoculations on and be stoked on 10-year mushroom patches. Wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, And somehow I got the idea, like several, like 5 years ago, I thought somebody had mentioned or I read a bit somewhere or something like that, that he spent, because like he's gone through multiple phases throughout his life of like what kinds of crops to do on his farm and what kinds of things. For a while, he had like a little wildlife preserve going on there, where he had like almost like a zoo. And people could come by and see all these weird animals that he had in his little zoo. And then it seemed like that for like 3 years, he kind of did the Paul Stamets thing. He was Mr. Mushrooms, and he was selling mushroom crops, and this was his thing. And I don't know, he would move into all these different things until, you know, and all of these things chipped into evolving to who he is now. So when it comes to mushrooms, I do know that one day, when he was in Washington a few years ago, it was like 2 or 3 hours were dedicated to mushroom stuff. But I kind of got the impression he was so bored with it, he turned it over to his son Yosef to teach that section, which I thought Yosef did like a superb job, and there were a lot of things I learned from it that I never knew before, and so it was really well done. But yeah, I think that there's going to be portions of stuff where it's like he's done it so much he's like tired of doing it and can't bear the thought. So anyway,
yeah.
I'm not sure. I'd like to get verification about whether or not he was, you know, he played Paul Stamets for 3 years or something. All right. That's as far as I read so far into the chapter. And once again, we're pegging out at about an hour. So anything else you want to say about what we read just now?
Nope, I think we're good.
All right. Well, if you like this sort of thing, come on out to the forums at permies.com, where we talk about, you know, SEP and homesteading and permaculture all the time.